So I want you to picture a spaceship re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. It is just tearing through the sky, glowing with heat, moving at a speed of about 8,000 meters per second.
Right, which is incredibly fast.
Yeah, orbital re-entry speed. But now picture a phase transformation happening entirely inside a solid piece of steel, a cold, solid piece of metal at 1,000 meters per second.
Sounds about as hard to wrap your head around.
It really is. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to explore a massive stack of sources on this. We've got textbook excerpts, complex crystallographic diagrams, detailed research notes, all breaking down the intense, frankly, mind-bending world of Martin Siddick phase transformations.
And it is genuinely one of the most extreme physical phenomena we observe in metallurgy.
Yeah.
I mean, 1,000 meters per second is an eighth of that reentry speed you mentioned, but it's occurring within a dense, solid, crystalline lattice.
Right. Not in the air, not in a vacuum. In solid metal.
Exactly. And what makes it even more fascinating is that our sources point out this transformation can sometimes happen at temperatures so intensely cold that helium actually liquefies.
Which completely defies our everyday logic of how solids should behave. You know, like when things get that close to absolute zero, we usually expect all atomic movement to just freeze up and stop entirely.
Yeah, thermodynamics usually says cold means slow.
Right. So to have an internal structural shift physically possible at those explosive speeds in a deep freeze, I mean, the atoms simply cannot be moving randomly.
No, they can't. Random motion just takes far too much time. Normally, when a metal changes phase, say, going from a liquid to a solid or rearranging its structure from one solid crystal to another, it relies on a process called diffusion.
Okay, let's unpack this because diffusion is basically uncoordinated, right?
Totally uncoordinated. It's the stochastic transport of atoms. They literally just bounce around, bump into each other, migrate across the lattice, eventually find a lower energy state, and, settle down.
Okay, so normal diffusion is fundamentally a game of probability. It's like people randomly milling around a crowded room trying to find the exit. It takes time, and people constantly get in each other's way.
That's a great way to put it, and it takes a lot of time. To put some hard numbers to it from the research, the absolute fastest recorded solidification rate driven by diffusion is about 80 meters per second.
And that's in a liquid, right?
Yeah, that was in pure liquid nickel, where atoms can flow pretty freely. When you look at random diffusional jumps happening in a dense solid state, it is just dramatically slower.
Like how slow?
Well, the sources highlight a massive solid-state transformation relying on random diffusional motion, and it clocks in at just 0.03 meters per second.
Wow. Okay, so comparing 0.03 meters per second to 1,000 meters per second is just absurd. Martin's sight has to be playing by completely different rules.
Oh, absolutely. It's what the texts call a diffusionless shear transformation.
Right, so instead of a room full of people bumping into each other, it's more like a flash mob. Like every single atom in that crystal lattice takes exactly one precise step to the left at the exact same millisecond.
Yes, that coordinated shift is literally the only way to achieve these phenomenal speeds. But, this flash mob has profound thermodynamic consequences.
Especially regarding the carbon, right? Because steel isn't just iron.
Exactly. You have to factor in the carbon atoms that are dissolved within that steel matrix. The velocity of this transformation interface is moving so incredibly fast that the carbon atoms simply do not have the time to diffuse away.
Because the interface is basically this like wall sweeping through the lattice faster than the carbon can run.
Precisely. The equations in our sources show that the velocity of the interface vastly exceeds the maximum speed at which carbon can jump from one interstitial site to another.
So they just get caught.
They get completely trapped. And because of that, the chemical potential of the carbon spikes massively. Thermodynamics dictates that the carbon really wants to precipitate out into a different phase, like cementite, just to lower its energy.
But it can't. It's physically barred from doing so.
Right. It becomes totally trapped in the newly formed martensite phase.
So there is a net reduction in the overall free energy for the iron lattice, which is why the transformation drives forward at all, but the carbon itself is effectively taken prisoner.
It's locked in place. And that trap sets the stage for basically everything that follows in terms of the metal's properties.
Okay, so we have this massive coordinated atomic shift trapping all this carbon in its wake. But if all these iron atoms are shifting simultaneously like a flash mob, what geometric shape are they actually taking? I mean, how does the lattice physically reconfigure itself on the fly?
Well, this is where we run into a really major crystallographic puzzle. We start with the parent phase of the steel, which is called austenite.
And austenite has a face-centered cubic structure, right? FCC.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine a microscopic cube of iron atoms with another iron atom sitting perfectly in the center of each of the six faces.
Oh, okay, I got the mental image.
During the flash mob, this entire grid needs to shift into a body-centered cubic or body-centered tetragonal structure, which we call ferrite or martensite.
So we are fundamentally changing the basic building block of the crystal, and the foundational theory for how this occurs is called the Bain strain, which the notes say was proposed way back in 1924.
Right, good old 1924. And according to the Bain strain, this shift involves compressing the austenite crystal by about 17% along one axis.
So squishing it down.
Yeah, and then uniformly expanding it by about 12% along the other two perpendicular axes.
Okay, so on paper, that sounds simple enough. The Bain strain beautifully maps the starting FCC lattice to the final BCC lattice.
It works perfectly if you're just looking at an isolated block of atoms. But there is a glaring physical problem when you scale it up to a real piece of metal.
Right, because it's not isolated, it's surrounded by other atoms.
Exactly. The transformation needs to happen smoothly across a boundary within the larger steel object. To keep the energy low enough for the transformation to proceed at high speed, the interface between the old austenite and the new martensite needs to be what we call an invariant plane.
An invariant plane, meaning a perfectly flat surface that doesn't get distorted or rotated at all during the shift.
Precisely. Because if it stretches or twists, the strain energy would skyrocket and the whole high-speed flash mob would just hit a wall and stop dead.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting to me. Since the Bain strain is mathematically necessary to get the right crystal shape, but it completely destroys that required flat invariant plane, the crystal basically has to figure out a mathematical workaround.
Yes.
It essentially has to cheat geometry to make this work, like adjusting a rigid picture frame. You want to change the shape, but you can't break the glass in the middle.
That's a fantastic analogy.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating here is that the phenomenological theory of martensite crystallography beautifully accounts for this cheating. Well, the theory says the transformation starts with a Bain strain to get the atoms to the right spots. But then, to fix the massive warping, it adds a rigid body rotation of the entire lattice.
So it spins the whole thing slightly.
Just enough to ensure that at least one single line remains completely undistorted. We call that an invariant line strain.
But wait, a single line isn't a two-dimensional plane. We still need a perfectly flat, undistorted interface.
Exactly. So to get from an invariant line to an invariant plane, the crystal undergoes a second, highly localized deformation. It essentially slides microscopic layers of the crystal over one another.
Like sliding a deck of cards?
Yes, you can push the top of the deck to the side, changing the overall macroscopic shape of the stack into, say, a slanted parallelogram.
But the physical rectangular shape of every individual card remains exactly the same.
Right. The crystal is doing exactly that on an atomic scale. It either introduces tiny microscopic steps, which we call slip, or it folds the lattice back and forth in a repeating accordion-like pattern, which we call twinning.
Okay, slip or twinning.
Yeah. And by introducing this inhomogeneous microscopic slipping or twinning, the problematic macroscopic shape change caused by the Bain strain is perfectly canceled out along that boundary.
So it goes through this intricate high-speed origami just to maintain a perfectly smooth interface so the reaction doesn't stop.
It goes to all this immense mathematical trouble just to reduce the massive strain energy. Otherwise, the growth would just halt.
But even with this elegant microscopic cheating, I have to ask, if this phase is expanding and shearing violently at 1,000 meters a second, doesn't the surrounding untransformed steel fight back?
Oh, it fights back immensely. The friction and internal stress are astronomical, and the physics of that battle dictate the kinetics, meaning how and when the martensite actually grows.
Because unlike many processes in metallurgy, the sources say this transformation is primarily a thermal.
Right, a thermal, meaning it is not a function of time. You don't just hold the steel at a specific temperature and wait for it to transform.
Like leaving a cake in the oven to bake, time doesn't matter here.
Yeah, not at all. It depends almost entirely on the temperature dropping below a specific threshold, called the martensite start temperature, or MIS.
And the sources dive into the Coyston and Marburger equation to mathematically describe this, right?
They do. And what that equation shows is that as you cool the steel further and further below that MIS temperature, the volume fraction of martensite increases.
Let's explore why that is. If it's not about time, why does the steel need to get colder and colder to keep the flash mob going?
Because of that strain energy barrier you just brought up, the surrounding austenite is fighting back. When the temperature first hits the emser point, there's just enough thermodynamic driving force to trigger the most potent, easiest nucleation sites in the crystal.
Okay, the easy ones pop first.
Right. But once those transform, they swell. They create massive internal stress in the surrounding area to force the remaining less potent sites to overcome that new, even higher strain energy barrier. You need a significantly larger driving force.
And in this system, you get that extra push by dropping the temperature even lower.
Exactly. The colder it gets, the more force you have to overcome the physical strain.
So it is literally a battle of thermodynamics versus physical strain driven by the deep freeze. But the sources also highlight something incredibly counterintuitive happening right at the interface.
The recalcitrance.
Yes. The growth is so violent that it actually releases a massive amount of latent heat into the surrounding metal.
Which is wild, right? This is where the kinetics become truly dynamic. The local temperature spikes because of this heat release.
But wait, we just established that the driving force relies on being extremely cold. So this localized heating actually reduces the driving force in real time as the martensite plate grows.
Exactly. It's literally generating its own brakes. As it heats up, it loses its driving force and slows down.
And you can physically see this recorded in the crystal structure, can't you?
You can. The electron microscope images in the sources show a single martensite plate. At the center, where it nucleated and grew extremely fast, the crystal accommodated the strain using that accordion-like twinning we talked about.
Because it was moving at top speed.
Right. But as it grows outward, the recalcitrance heats the local area, the driving force drops, the interface velocity slows down, and the physical mechanism for accommodation actually shifts.
It changes its strategy mid-growth.
Yeah. It transitions from twinning at the center to slip at the outer edges. The entire history of its deceleration is permanently recorded right there in the microstructure.
That is just wild. And even as it slows down, it is still pushing massive stress into the surrounding austenite. So what happens when a growing martensite plate finally hits a physical barrier, like an austenite grain boundary or another martensite plate?
Well, all that accumulated stress has to go somewhere. It doesn't just dissipate.
Right. Energy doesn't just vanish.
Exactly. The stress field is so intense that it can physically force a neighboring area of austenite to transform. That new area then stresses another area, creating a cascading chain reaction.
The sources call this the burst phenomenon, right?
Yes, the burst phenomenon. It creates this striking zigzag array of martensite plates across the metal.
And that zigzag shape isn't random. They form in those specific angled orientations to mutually accommodate each other's strain.
Right. They are essentially trying to cancel out the bulk distortion of the metal. They're desperately trying to balance the internal tension.
Okay. So we've tracked this high-speed, heat-generating, zigzagging atomic origami. But let's bring it back to the listener. If you're holding a piece of hardened steel, why does this flash mob matter to the tool in your hand?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. How does the specific chaotic transformation translate to incredible real-world strength?
Well, the secret to the macroscopic strength brings us right back to the very beginning. Remember the trapped carbon atoms?
The prisoners of the flash mob.
Exactly. To understand why steel gets so hard, we need to look at the interstitial spaces, the microscopic gaps between the iron atoms where the carbon actually lives.
Right, because in the parent austenite phase, those gaps are evenly distributed. There is exactly one octahedral space available per iron atom. It's perfectly symmetrical.
But when the flash mob triggers and the lattice shifts to Faraday, the geometry changes. Suddenly, there are three sets of octahedral spaces available per iron atom.
Which sounds like the carbon just got a massive upgrade in living space, like moving from a one-bedroom to a three-bedroom apartment.
It would be if the carbon had time to move in and spread out. But remember, this is a diffusionless transformation happening at up to 1,000 meters a second.
Zero time to pack up and move.
Zero time. So the carbon atoms cannot politely rearrange themselves evenly across those three new sublattices. Because of the specific way the Bain strain shears the lattice, all the carbon atoms from the original austenite are forced onto just one of those three sets of sublattices in the new phase.
Oh, wow. So you have three times the theoretical space, but all the carbon is jammed into a single corridor. So to put this in perspective for you listening, this carbon trap is like taking all the clothes from a perfectly packed normal-sized suitcase and instantly shoving them into a single tiny pocket of a carry-on bag. You literally have to sit on the bag to zip it shut. The internal pressure pushing outward is just massive.
That is exactly what's happening. And that outward pressure physically distorts the entire iron crystal. The unevenly packed carbon forces the normally symmetrical cubic lattice to elongate along one axis.
It warps the actual structure.
Yeah, it turns into a body-centered tetragonal lattice, or BCT. The entire crystal is basically bulging under the immense strain of the trapped carbon.
And the sources use the Snook peak to prove this, which I found fascinating because the Snook peak measures internal friction. Let's break that down. If you take a piece of normal, slow-cooled ferrite and apply an alternating stress to it, the carbon atoms are free to jump back and forth between those three sublattices.
Right. They have mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And that jumping motion physically absorbs energy from the applied stress, which registers as a high Snook peak on a graph. It shows the carbon is highly mobile.
But when they measured the Snook peak in this fast-formed Martin site, it just flatlined. The peak is tiny.
Because the carbon cannot jump. It is completely pinned in place.
Stuck in that tiny suitcase pocket.
Exactly. And to make matters worse, the violent shear of the transformation generates an absolutely massive density of dislocations.
Dislocations being the linear defects in the crystal lattice.
Yes. And we are talking 10 to the 11th to 10 to the 12th dislocations per square centimeter.
Which, correct me if I'm wrong, is similar to the defect density of a heavily cold worked metal. Like a piece of wire you bend back and forth repeatedly until it becomes completely brittle and snaps.
It's a perfect comparison. So you have this BCT lattice bulging with trapped carbon, and it's heavily pinned by billions of dislocations. Any external force trying to bend, cut, or deform that piece of steel has to overcome that massive built-in internal stress field first.
It's pre-stressed.
Exactly. The sources note that the actual yield stress of the steel, the point where it permanently bends, is fundamentally proportional to the square root of that trapped carbon concentration.
So the steel is incredibly strong because it is already fighting an intense atomic battle against itself. It's locked in a state of frozen tension.
That internal tension is the defining characteristic of hardened steel. It's why your tools don't break.
Which sets up just an incredible premise. If this immense internal tension, the zigzag microstructure, the trapped carbon, if all of this was created purely by a thermal drop, what happens if we manipulate that temperature again? Can we make the flash mob step back to the right and, you know, undo the shear?
That concept is brilliant, and it leads us directly into the world of shape memory alloys.
Right, shape memory.
Yeah. When we discussed the burst phenomenon earlier, we noted that the different variants of martensite form in zigzag patterns that accommodate each other.
Yeah, to balance the tension.
So the overall macroscopic shape of the metal block doesn't change drastically. The distortion is handled entirely internally. But if you take that martensitic piece of metal and physically bend it, you upset that delicate internal balance.
You're adding external stress to the mix.
Exactly. And that applied stress favors one specific variant over the others. So the favorable variant grows, consuming the others to relieve the stress, and the metal permanently bends.
Or so it appears to the naked eye.
Exactly. Because the transformation is highly crystallographically reversible. If you heat that bent metal back up above its transformation temperature, pushing it out of the martensite phase and back into its original austenite phase, the shear reverses.
The crystal structure goes back to its original symmetrical FCC lattice.
Right. And as the lattice shifts back, the macroscopic piece of metal physically morphs back to its original shape. It basically remembers where it came from.
It remembers. That is incredible. And, you know, while most people immediately associate shape memory with expensive nickel-titanium alloys like nitinol, which they use in medical stents, or those flexible eyeglass frames that snap back when you sit on them, the sources highlight that this exact martensitic mechanism exists in much cheaper iron-based shape memory alloys.
Yes, iron-based SMAs. They are much more accessible for large-scale engineering.
And engineers put this to use in an incredibly high-stakes scenario. The notes detail how they literally use these iron-based shape memory plates to save a century-old bridge from collapsing.
It's one of my favorite real-world applications.
It's amazing. So they manufactured these iron-based plates and purposefully stretched them by 2.5%, inducing a plastic strain.
Right. They applied force to make the martensite variants reorient and elongate.
Yeah. Then they bolted these elongated plates directly onto the failing steel beams of the bridge, just strapped them on. Finally, they attached ceramic heating pads to the plates and cranked up the temperature, driving the metal back to the austenite phase.
Which triggers the reverse flash mob.
Exactly. As the lattice sheared back, The plates desperately tried to shrink back to their original remembered length, but because they were heavily bolted to the bridge beams, they physically couldn't shrink.
They were trapped.
Right. So instead, that atomic desire to return to shape generated an astonishing 74 megapascals of compressive force against the bridge.
That is a staggering amount of force.
By simply heating up a flat piece of metal, they generated enough continuous force to physically squeeze and reinforce an entire civil structure.
It really is a phenomenal application. We take a subatomic lattice shear happening at immense speeds and literally harness its stored kinetic energy to hold a bridge together.
What a journey this has been. I mean, we started with an atomic flash mob tearing through a crystal lattice at 1,000 meters per second, an eighth of orbital reentry speed occurring in a deep freeze.
Yep.
We unpacked how the crystal bends the rules of geometry, utilizing the Bain strain and that microscopic sliding deck origami just to keep its interface perfectly flat.
And we explored how that high-speed, heat-generating transformation traps carbon in a severely distorted corridor.
The overstuffed atomic suitcase?
Right, the suitcase locked down by billions of dislocations, which is the foundational secret to the immense hardness of quenched steel.
And finally, we saw how manipulating that thermal switch can reverse the flash mob entirely, allowing solid steel plates to shape-shift and hug a century-old bridge tight enough to save it from ruin.
The elegance of material science is that it connects the invisible to the monumental. The next time you use a hardened steel tool or drive your car over a reinforced steel bridge, you don't have to just see a dull, static piece of metal.
You can picture what's actually going on inside.
Exactly. You can picture that frozen, microscopic choreography of atoms locked in massive, deliberate tension right beneath the surface.
Well said. And here is a final thought for you to chew on as we wrap up this deep dive. Right now, we trigger these massive instantaneous structural shifts by broadly tweaking the temperature or applying brute force stress. We heat a plate and it pulls.
Right, it's a bulk reaction.
But imagine the future. Imagine what happens when we eventually learn to control the exact variant selection of every single crystal on command without needing bulk temperature changes. Could we eventually build macro structures like skyscrapers or even the spacecraft we talked about at the beginning that don't just sit rigidly but actively morph, adapt to aerodynamic loads, and literally flex in real time like living, breathing muscle?
When atoms can coordinate at 1,000 meters a second.
Anything is possible.